Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. President Trump has made enormous, unsubstantiated claims about voter fraud in the 2016 election. No evidence. Now he's created a commission to look around. It's been named the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. It met for the first time yesterday. Critics call it a propaganda tool, a launchpad for voter suppression. The commission heads say they just want the facts. This hour on Point, the president's controversial voter fraud commission. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do we have a voting problem, an allegation problem? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will look at the impact of John McCain's newly reported brain cancer on Capitol Hill politics. But first, American voting. Joining me from Washington to bring us up to date is Deborah Barry, Washington correspondent for USA Today. She's been covering the administration's voter fraud efforts for the paper, and you can find links to her reporting on our website, onpointradio.org. Deborah Barry, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what does the administration say this commission is for, and what are its critics saying?
As you know, President Trump set up this commission in May basically to look into some of his claims of voter fraud, particularly in last year's election.
Mm-hmm.
He claims there were 3 to 5 million people who voted illegally. We set up this commission, which can have up to about 15 members. Right now it has about 12, to look into it over a period of about 9 months. It had its first meeting on yesterday. Meanwhile, a lot of voting rights groups, Democrats and civil rights groups, are claiming that it's more of an effort to look more into voter suppression, which they've claimed has been happening in many of the states in the last few years anyway, whether it be voter ID laws or other election law changes that they think will make it harder for folks to vote or go to the polls.
There was a lot of heat when this commission put out a preliminary request or request for lots of information about voters and voting rolls
right. To
all 50 states, a month or two ago now.
Right.
How has that played out? Are states delivering that or not?
No. Well, actually, Vice Chair Chris Kobach sent this letter to the states and the territories on June 28th. And in that letter, he asked for a lot of voter data. Everything from some of the last Social Security numbers to voting histories, all kind of data that a lot of the states actually had. There was a lot of pushback from not just Secretaries of State who were Democrats, but also Republicans. A lot of them saying, we're not going to do that. It's not going to happen. Some of them saying we'll comply partially with some of the information that's already publicly available. But there was a lot of pushback because a lot of folks were concerned, number one, that these are states and that they don't, you know, elections are run by states, and they don't want the feds to kind of stepping in. And some saying that, you know, this is data that we need to protect or voter information that we need to protect. And, again, Mississippi Secretary of State made it perfectly clear that he's not giving up the information and basically told them that they can go kind of, you know, jump in the Gulf. And then you have Democrats, of course, many of them saying, no, we're not going to do this because we figure you're going to use this information, again, to more suppress voter turnout.
Is there – the president's made quite dramatic claims, 3 to 5 million illegal votes in last fall's election. And of course, if that margin is true, it would – that's an important number because or a range of numbers because it would give him the popular vote, which Hillary Clinton won by 2.8 million votes in the official count.
Exactly.
Is there evidence that there's any truth to the president's assertion?
Well, there are a lot of voting rights experts, election officials say that that's not the case. That there, if anything, they say voter fraud doesn't happen hardly at all, if at all. And some groups and other groups, and there are a few who argue that there are some, including I think one of your guests later on, Heritage, argues that there are about 1,000 cases that they found. But for the most part, most groups and on both sides say at least in terms of voting experts, say that that's not the case.
1,000 cases, but that's over quite a number of years. President Trump's talking about 3 to 5 million votes last November.
Right. And, of course, there are millions of people who vote each year, period, whether it be, you know, for your federal elections, your local elections, et cetera. So over that period of time, most experts are arguing that number one, isn't rampant voter fraud, and two, the numbers are so small as they are that it definitely doesn't make those claims come to true.
This is described as a bipartisan commission. There are seven Democrats and seven Republicans and five Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
The chair is Vice President Mike Pence. The vice chair, Kris Kobach of Kansas, Secretary of State there, who's been very active with charges, claims, and sort of tightening requirements for voting on this front. Why, if it's bipartisan, why are the chair and vice chair both Republican? Why is it 7-5 in its membership?
Well, bipartisan just means that there's a Democrat and there's a Republican. And a lot of members of Congress, as you well know, will say bipartisan in a minute on a bill just because they have a Democrat or a Republican on it. So they can argue that it's bipartisan, and it is. Some of the voting rights advocates and civil rights advocates are arguing that while you may call it bipartisan, that the two heads of the committee are Republicans. And one of them in particular, they argue, has promoted and advocated for more, quote, restrictive election laws. So they already feel in that way that it's already somewhat slanted. Again, this is coming from them. They also argue that some of the members have had strong opinions about it, particularly about more restrictive laws. So they already feel like that while you can call it bipartisan, that there's a clear slant intent toward more restrictive laws.
Deborah Barry with USA Today. We appreciate your being with us for a minute today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Vice President Pence was there to kick it off. He's the chair of the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. Here he was gaveling in the inaugural meetings, and his commissioner was going into the effort with an open mind.
This commission, let me be clear, this commission has no preconceived notions or preordained results. We're fact finders. And in the days ahead, we will gather the relevant facts and data, and at the conclusion of our work, we will present the president with a report of our findings.
Okay, no preconceived notions. His vice chair, though, Kris Kobach of Kansas, talked immediately about lingering doubts as things got underway, about integrity, about fairness.
For a long time, there's been lingering doubt among many Americans about the integrity and fairness of elections, and it's not a new issue at all. If you look at the polling data, it goes back decades. Public opinion has been consistent on this in that there is a substantial number of people who wonder if our elections are fair.
No preconceived notions, but here was the president yesterday talking pretty tough. And, of course, he's the one who's made the huge claims about fraud in last fall's election, unsubstantiated, without evidence. But here he was at the opening yesterday.
Every time voter fraud occurs, it cancels out the vote of a lawful citizen and undermines democracy. Can't let that happen. Any form of illegal or fraudulent voting, whether by non-citizens or the deceased, and any form of voter suppression or intimidation must be stopped.
This commission asked for a lot of information from all 50 states and territories, got a lot of pushback on that. Among those pushing back was Secretary of State for the state of Connecticut, Denise Merrill. She just finished her term as president of the National Association of Secretaries of State, still co-chairs that group's Cybersecurity Task Force, a Democrat out of Connecticut. She joins us now from Hartford. Denise Merrill, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be here, Tom.
You pushed back on the information request. Let's just start there. Why did you do that?
I certainly did. I think the idea that for the first time in our history, we would have a national voter list with all voters' information in one place, this is just the worst thing we could do, particularly at this point in time. This flies in the face of everything that has gone on around elections. Elections have been a local affair, not just a state issue, but it's really managed at the local level. So voter lists, for example, are managed by literally hundreds of thousands of county and town clerks and registrars who are the only ones who are allowed to take names off and on the list. So the idea that we would suddenly collect all that information by a national government agency of some sort, not even on an official computer, apparently, we were told that this would all reside at the White House, at a computer at the White House. So that strikes me as a very dangerous thing.
Why?
Well, I mean, right now, of all times, we've had all these questions about the security of our databases, about the incursions that have been made. You know, there are questions about foreign interference, about how many times a day people are trying to get into these voter registration databases. And at the state and local level, we have multiple checks and balances already in place. And I think that's why you're seeing the pushback among all the secretaries of state, is that we feel that by questioning, I mean, we already do all this. We check our lists. We have backup files. We have election enforcement commissions in every state that do prosecute instances of voter fraud and so forth. And I feel like it almost impugns the reputation and integrity of every election official in the country by saying that somehow 3 to 5 million people slipped through the cracks and somehow were able to vote. You know, you can see where this would raise everyone's hackles.
They say they want to compare voting lists between states because sometimes somebody will move from one state to another, and then they're on two voting lists. They want to straighten that out. Can states do that on their own?
Yes, we already do that. There is a system that is very highly regarded as compared with the cross-check system that Secretary Kobach's talking about. It's called ERIC. It was developed by the Pew Foundation, and it works very well. It's a membership situation, and so there's about 20 states now that have joined. We cross-check our death records, for example. And really, the modern problem is people move all the time, and theoretically they're in charge of their own registration, so they're the ones, the voter, are the one that's supposed to change your registration, but we all know that doesn't always happen. But that's not a crime. That's, you know, being on two lists is not voting twice. It's being on two lists. So we're rapidly straightening it out. As a matter of fact, I think our voting lists are probably cleaner and more accurate than they have been in years right now.
So you're reluctant on the sharing front. What about the commission itself? Is it a good thing to have a commission looking into election integrity or not?
Count me as one that's very suspicious of their motives. I think you have seen, for the first time in many, many years, a rash of new requirements to register to vote. And I don't think anyone would argue that it does make it harder to register and vote. Particularly for certain groups that don't have the requisite ID. And in Kansas, it's actually citizenship papers, which, by the way, is in court to see if it is discriminatory, which I believe it probably is.
Secretary of State for Connecticut, Denise Merrill, we're really glad that you've come on for just a minute with us today and grateful for it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's controversial new voter fraud commission getting underway and the true state of American election integrity. You can join us this hour. Have you heard Donald Trump shout fraud before and after the election? Do you believe him? And at what scale, if any? Do you believe the commission is out to get the truth or to try and back up the president's unsubstantiated claims? And have you seen problems, real problems, with our election integrity? Does this look like the right focus? Is the commission on the right path here? In an interview with NPR's All Things Considered 2 or 3 weeks ago, Kansas Secretary of State, Vice Chairman of the Commission, Chris Kobach of Kansas, said the purpose of the group does not have to do with President Trump's claims of mass voter fraud. Here's part of that exchange with NPR's Ari Shapiro.
The commission's purpose is not to prove or disprove what President Trump said back in January or February.
Every objective observer has said there is zero evidence of millions of people voting illegally. It seems striking that as one of the leaders of a commission on voting integrity, you're not willing to say the same.
Well, I guess it all depends on what you define as evidence, right?
Okay, we'll look at that. It's not to prove or disprove what the president said, but yesterday, the Kansas Republican, Kobach, said that we may never know the answer to the question of whether or not Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote. We may never know the answer. He was talking with Katie Tour here on MSNBC, and here's part of that exchange.
You think that maybe Hillary Clinton did not win the popular vote?
We may never know the answer to that question.
How do you say we may never know the answer to that question? Really? Really? You really believe that?
Well, what I'm saying is, let's suppose that the commission determined that there were a certain number of votes cast by ineligible voters. You still won't know whether those people who are ineligible voted for Trump or for Clinton or for somebody else. And so it's impossible to ever know exactly, if you took out all the ineligible votes, what the final tally would be in that election.
That is quite a question mark to put over an American presidential election. We may never know the answer. The vice chair of the new commission yesterday. I want to look at what's going on with the commission and what may come out of it. Joining us from Washington right now is Jason Sneed. He's a policy analyst at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. They've put together a database there of cases of voter fraud, a few more than 1,000 proven instances, they say, mostly in the last decade, but they go much further back than that. He joins us from Washington. Jason Sneed, thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, thank you for having me.
And from Berkeley, California, Vanita Gupta is with us, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. She was principal deputy assistant attorney general, head of the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division under President Obama. Her recent op-ed in the New York Times is headlined, "The Voter Purges Are Coming." You can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. She's former legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Vanita Gupta, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Jason Sneed, how do you see the mission of this commission?
Well, I think that the mission of the Election Integrity Commission is pretty straightforward. It's to examine vulnerabilities in our electoral system to ensure that every American's vote is counted accurately and that the elections reflect the will of the people. And when the president signed the executive order authorizing the creation of this commission, he made it clear that we're looking not only at problems with voter registration and the balloting process itself, but we're also looking at legitimate efforts to intimidate and suppress voters. So a lot of the rhetoric that has surrounded this commission, I think, has been a bit misleading, because the commission is looking at all threats to democracy, and that really is what this is about, the core of the very democratic process itself.
Vanita, you say it may be all about voter suppression, voter purges. Justify that.
Well, there are a number of indications as to why that is the case. I mean, if you looked at and watched the hearing yesterday, it was highly tilted towards trying to examine voter fraud. And the reality is, as you said, there's just been no evidence of mass voter fraud. There have been a number of studies that have looked at it. I will also say that the composition of the commission, I call it the voter suppression dream team. You have Kris Kobach, who has led a crusade against the motor voter bill, which was enacted in 1993 to help ensure that there was greater access to registration, as well as to make sure that voter lists were updated. But he has been sued at least three times and sanctioned most recently in a court case right before the 2016 election, was found to have illegally blocked tens of thousands of voters from registering. You have Ken Blackwell, who had rejected registration forms because they were printed on paper that was considered too thin. Hans von Spakovsky, J. Christian Adams, these are two individuals who have been leading charges to diminish voter participation. J. Christian Adams published personal information about people who he had wrongly accused of committing multiple felonies in a flawed hunt for fraud. The composition of this and coming in the aftermath of completely unsubstantiated claims by President Trump about 3 to 5 million voters who may have voted illegally in the last election, I think really call into question the very nature of this commission and lead us to believe that it is a sham. And it has resulted in secretaries of state of both parties resisting the request for data for these reasons and in multiple pieces of litigation.
There's no question, Jason Sneed, that the vice chair, Kris Kobach, has been very tough and has gone after the motor voter law that made it more easy and convenient for people to get into registration roles. But you say that it's just a kind of a, well, we just want to see if things are all right in here. Hasn't he already shown the direction he'd like to take voting?
Registration? Well, I think I think that the commission, if you listen to the statements, and I was there to hear the statements in person yesterday, the statements of the commissioners, it's a bipartisan group, and they are all taking this issue very seriously. This is a fact-finding panel. It's going to go where the evidence leads, and there are no, as the vice president said, preordained outcomes or predetermined results. The policy recommendations that the commission ultimately decides upon for release will be decided upon by the commission as a whole, and they will be a result of the commission's evidence and fact-finding. And, you know, I'd like to say that I work with Hans von Spakovsky at Heritage, and I've found him to be a dedicated public servant to the extreme. And I think that, quite frankly, some of the rhetoric around the commission is just completely inaccurate. I think that we're going to, for the first time in quite a while, have a complete or very nearly complete, I hope, look at the state of the American electoral system. And ultimately, if we have a choice between ignorance of the facts or to have the command of the full facts regarding something as important as our elections, I would certainly hope that we would choose the latter course.
Do you think, I mean, the president of the United States who created the commission said that he won the popular vote if you take away the millions of people who voted illegally. Does that sound factual to you? Does it sound credible? Does it sound anything close?
Well, I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that there are as many votes as the president has suggested that were cast illegally. But then, you know, that is kind of the question that we are talking about today. We need to be able to examine the voter registration records. We need to be able to examine the electoral process as a whole. And if that evidence exists, then I'm sure that it will make itself manifest in short order. But regardless of
But you talked about ignorance, right?
And right.
Is there any informed view that would support the president's characterization of the November election?
Well, I would say that just by way of pushback a little bit, that we don't need to have a mass conspiracy or millions of votes for voter fraud to be a significant challenge to the threat of our election. In fact, it was a Democratic Secretary of State, Bill Gardner, who made that point in the commission yesterday when he told the commission that he has personally handled hundreds of recounts and has taken care of dozens of elections that have been either tied or decided by fewer than 10 votes. So only a handful of votes can swing the results of elections. We don't need to have a nationwide conspiracy in order to take this issue seriously. And in our Heritage Voter Fraud Database, we have multiple instances of elections that were ultimately overturned on the order of a judge because there was sufficient fraud to swing the results. And in some cases, the results turned out much differently on the second election.
Vinita Gupta, the envelope here or the messaging is, what's the harm in looking? What do you say to that?
The problem is that the commission's acting as though nobody else has been looking. And there have been any number of studies that have been highly validated that have not found zero evidence of voter fraud. In fact, you just heard the Secretary of State from Connecticut talk about how secretaries of state, this is what they do. Election officials locally are deeply engaged in ongoing processes constantly to ensure that voter rolls are updated. What we know is that many members of this commission have made wildly inflated claims. You're talking about the Heritage Foundation having a database of claiming to have 1,000 instances of voter fraud over the span of what I understand to be not just the past decade, but a few decades.
Back to the 1940s, I think.
Back to the 1940s. And so, you know, it isn't that people haven't been looking. Of course, we need to keep voter rolls updated. They need to be accurate. In fact, the National Voter Registration Law, which is the Motor Voter Bill, has a process by which that needs to occur. And what is highly curious here is that this commission gets formed in the aftermath of President Trump making these wild claims about 3 to 5 million voters who've potentially voted illegally and is set up with members of this commission that have been throughout the last many years using scintilla of evidence to try to enact more voter restrictive voting laws around in states around the country that have been found by numerous courts to have engaged in illegal blocking of voter registration and the like. And so it simply kind of boggles the mind how anyone can think that we're just afraid of the evidence. This is part of an ongoing process of ensuring democratic participation and access to voter registration that local officials and academics have done deep studies on, and the evidence simply does not show voter fraud.
Jason Sneed, why the big emphasis here? We know the president made claims, enormous claims, but I think it's fair to say that No one has put forward any evidence coming close to justifying those claims. You might characterize them as wild claims, as Vanita did. The Americans having confidence in their voting is, of course, important. But if you start with the premise of a mischaracterization, as the president appears to have done in the absence of evidence for last fall, quite a large one, can that not sort of prejudice the outcome? And does it not undermine the confidence that you say you're looking to shore up?
Well, I don't think that the commission is beginning with any preconceived notions about the scale or scope of voter fraud or the problems which are confronting our election officials.
Well, you have the vice chair saying we may never know whether or not the official count of the popular vote was correct last fall. We just heard him say that yesterday. We may never know. That seems to me a pretty big question mark raised right there without substantiation.
Well, we certainly know that there are serious challenges to the electoral process.
In the millions? At that scale?
Well, let's look at a Pew study in 2012 that found that 24 million voter registrations, that's nearly 1 in 8, are inaccurate or out of date. Nearly 3 million people at the time were registered in multiple states, and nearly 2 million voters were on the rolls despite the fact that they were apparently deceased.
But do those numbers, I take those numbers, but do they, and you know, you look at this, do they credibly suggest voting at the national scale that's off by millions? Do they even hundreds? At all?
Well, once again, I want to reiterate that I do not believe that the problem of voter fraud only needs to be confronted if it's in the millions or tens of millions, because there are literally thousands of down-ballot races that are decided by one or two votes. In New Hampshire, a Senate race was decided by fewer than 1,000 votes. We have swing states across the country that are deciding on who is going to be joining Congress and who is going to be the next president, decided by incredibly tight margins. It doesn't require millions of votes to be a serious issue, and quite frankly, we bury our heads in the sand at our own peril. When we try to push the voter fraud argument off as a de minimis problem, then we're really sort of saying we're going to just tolerate some small amount of fraud. We wouldn't do that in the bank fraud context. We wouldn't just tolerate some amount of bank fraud as the cost of doing business. So when it comes to something as critical as electoral integrity, which is imperative for people to have trust in the integrity of the democratic process itself, why should we just tolerate some small amount of fraud?
And yet the president's allegation is anything but de minimis. He's talking about millions and millions of votes. You can see how that could spin people's heads, right? He said, I would have won if you deduct the people who voted illegally. That means millions. That's not de minimis.
Sure, but you know the objections that have been raised by people when they're trying to rebut the very existence of the commission is that voter fraud, I mean, we just heard it from Ms. Gupta, that voter fraud is either non-existent or virtually non-existent. And you know, our voter fraud database really disproves that notion entirely. We've compiled more than 1,000, nearly 1,100 instances of proven fraud.
And going back to when? 1945? Is that the right date?
We have one entry from 1948, but I want to make one thing clear to your listeners, that this is not intended to be a comprehensive sweep of American elections. It's not intended even to be a representative sampling. It's intended to prove that voter fraud exists, and that's why we have limited this to instances where there is proven voter fraud, whether it results in a criminal conviction, which we have nearly 1,000 of those in the database, or some other form of proof.
Over half a century. How many votes, you know, cast in that time? A billion or something?
Well, but again, that's, I think, the wrong metric to be evaluating this by.
Well, it would be, except for this, that you can create headwinds out of this that deter people from voting. And so you always have to balance it, don't you, in an open democracy?
Well, I certainly think that you have to balance making voting as easy as possible for legitimate voters, for eligible voters, with the important protections that are in place to ensure that their votes are not being effectively discounted by someone who's voting twice. And when we're talking about voter fraud that may be just a handful of votes, is that something that's worth considering? Well, that can swing elections. We have proof of that in our database. And I would argue that for the people who are effectively being disenfranchised because someone is taking it upon themselves to stuff absentee ballots or vote twice in an election, it's probably not a minor thing for the person who just lost effectively their
voice. Vanita Gupta, you're saying the disenfranchisement can run the opposite direction and at scale.
Look, I ran the Civil Rights Division and oversaw the voting section of the Civil Rights Division, where we were litigating in North Carolina and Texas, two states that had enacted what both federal appellate courts found to be intentionally racially discriminatory voter ID laws, where hundreds of thousands of people were had been found to have been wrongly prevented from accessing the polls. If you want to talk about real voting issues and real voter disenfranchisement and problems in voting, we have them in this country. We absolutely do. We have cyber attacks. We have Russian interference with our elections. We have aging machines. We have these discriminatory state laws. And there we are talking about a significant mass of voters that are being prevented from accessing the polls or having their votes counted. That flies in the face of the Heritage Foundation's 1,000 people voter database dating back to 1945, and having an entire commission that is on this witch hunt and fishing expedition for evidence that has simply over and over again not been found to have established mass voter fraud. So you tell me what is a sham about this commission and what its real agenda is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's controversial new voter fraud commission getting underway and the true state of American election integrity. We're going to look in a few minutes at the impact of Senator John McCain's news of brain cancer, what that may mean on Capitol Hill and wider American politics. Vanita Gupta is with us. She was at the ACLU. She was head of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. She is now at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. She joins us from Berkeley, California. Jason Sneed is here from the Heritage Foundation. He is one of the guys who's put together a big list of examples of voter fraud, but a thousand or so cases going back to 1948 in this country, a time of many, many elections, of course. You can join us. What do you see in this new commission? Do you see it's designed to clean up the vote or to cast doubt on, even suppress the vote? Do you see an open mind here, a preset agenda? Lots of callers for the two of you. Chris in Birmingham, Michigan. Chris, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Let's just put this into the terms that we've heard a lot about lately. I view this as a witch hunt, okay?
Why?
A non-existent problem that's been scooped up and dramatized by the president. The whole thing is nothing but fake news. That's all it is. I work as a poll worker, and I take it as an insult to every poll worker, every city clerk, every county clerk, that we take our job seriously and we check and double check every name that comes in, every person that comes across to come in and vote for whatever they're voting for. I take it as an insult that this man thinks that he lost by 3 million votes. Let's take another look at that. He actually didn't lose by 3 million votes. What about the 7 million other people that voted for independent and other people that ran for president? That's almost 10 million people. So for him to say that he lost by 3 million votes is ludicrous.
Chris, we got it. You want to stack it up in the opposite direction. As a poll worker, you feel insulted by the allegation, and we hear it loud and clear. Let me get a call from New Orleans. Robert, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Okay.
I have a couple of things. One is an opinion. One couple is a question. I'd like to know what this substantial amount of the American population that believes this is an important problem, what that number is. That's number one. Number two, if these people are so certain that we'll never know whether Hillary Clinton won the popular election or not, why don't they ask the question that we can't be sure whether President Trump won the electoral votes? I see this clearly as coming from one side. And also, since Trump ran on this whole swamp of Washington, why would you want to create a commission to try to handle something between 50 states? That is clearly a responsibility of those states. If you so strongly believe that Washington is the wrong place to settle any problems, I think I agree completely with Ms. Gupta that they want to investigate problems with voting, they ought to investigate problems with disenfranchisement, because I'm 70-plus years old. I've been voting all my life, and I've always found the voting process to be something that's pretty close to the citizen, pretty close to the area, the county, the state, whatever. And I think Donald Trump said that the election, the inauguration had the most people on it ever. He just says these things, and then suddenly there's a commission. I find the whole thing absurd, and I don't understand why these unsubstantiated claims can't be clearly rejected and called out for what they are.
Robert, we hear people doing that, absolutely. At the same time, you've got a sitting president and his vice president, who's now the chair of this commission, and so on, pushing their agenda as well. I appreciate your call. Vanita Gupta, what about American attitudes on this? Do Americans think they have a big problem with voting? I guess that starts to become a difficult question when you've got a president who's telling them they do.
I mean, that is the problem. We are in a deeply polarized time in this country. And just before the election, I think it was in the middle of October, the then candidate Donald Trump tweeted about how there's mass voter fraud. I can't remember the exact wording of the tweet, but alleging that millions of voters, there would be millions of illegal voters voting in the upcoming presidential election. And so, you know, all of that is it lays deep suspicion and groundwork for people believing that indeed there is mass voter fraud. I mean, here's the problem is if you really want to improve public confidence in our election process, officials need to stop spreading lies and look at the evidence that has been examined, that exists, that has been validated by Republican and Democratic secretaries of state around the country about what's happening in their communities and in their states around elections. And so, you know, I don't think that there are polls that suggest all kinds of things along a spectrum. But when you have influencers of the type like the president pushing these messages out, it has a deep influence on what people actually believe.
Your warning in your op-ed piece, you say the voter purges are coming. What do you mean by that? What's your concern?
Well, this is just knowing how both the Justice Department and Kris Kobach work. But at the Justice Department enforces the motor voter law. They, too, have been asking for information from the motor voter covered states. But this commission can take a scintilla of evidence of voter fraud that they believe they found and basically create this national database and use it to count and check on whether there are double voters, for instance, across states.
What's wrong with that?
Well, the reality is that there is a high number of false positives. The commission won't be able to tell whether two people with the same name and birthday are different. In fact, this is part of a program that Kris Kobach has been running called CrossCheck that has gotten some notoriety of late. CrossCheck program openly admits in its participation guide that the program generates a high number of false positives. And that's why you saw states like Oregon and Florida actually leave that database. You heard from Secretary of State Merrill talk about how there's diminishing confidence in that program because of the number of high positives. And it has a specifically disproportionate impact on people of color. The U.S. Census has found that minorities are overrepresented in 85 of 100 of the most common last names. And so it's rife with error in the way that CrossCheck has been established. And these national databases then can form the basis for unlawful purges. There's ongoing litigation. And in fact, the Supreme Court is going to be taking up a case. But there's been ongoing litigation in Georgia and Ohio for unlawful voter purging that has resulted in countless. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands and in one instance, more than hundreds of thousands of voters being disenfranchised as a result of unlawful purging.
Jason Sneed, are you concerned at all about disenfranchisement as this gears up, that we may see Americans who are deterred from voting by new defenses that are put up, maybe for a relatively small number of problems in the system?
Well, I'm truthfully not, because there has been litigation on this issue. There were court cases last year, for example, where no one in voter ID states who was actually disenfranchised was able to be produced to testify that they had actually lost the right to vote because they were asked for some form of identification. I'm, you know, absolutely in agreement with what Ms. Gupta just said about the state of partisanship that we have in this country today, and I would certainly hope that we would engage in civil dialogue and discourse, but I don't think that all of the rhetoric that we're hearing surrounding this commission and calling into question
the
motivations
of it. You mean saying we may never know if Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, that kind of rhetoric?
Well, look, all rhetoric from all sides, but in particular, questioning the motivations of the people on this commission, many of whom are Democrats and serious people on this issue, I think that really sets the wrong tone for this entire discussion.
Tone has been set from a lot of angles here. I think we've heard them all today, and I appreciate that. Jason Steen of the Heritage Foundation, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Vanita Gupta at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Thank you for being here today, Ms. Gupta.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, Senator John McCain battles brain cancer. We'll look at what that means for the Senate. This is On Point. Yesterday, Arizona Senator John McCain's doctors revealed that he has a serious form of brain cancer. McCain's a fixture on Capitol Hill and on the nation's TV screens. To find out what Washington politics might look like even with even a temporary absence of his vote and voice, I'm joined by Sean Sullivan, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Sean, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So what is the severity of this at this point? Do we know what the path for treatment is and how promising it may be?
Well, we really don't. And I think right now, Senator McCain and his family are looking at their options. What we do know is that in general, this is a very serious diagnosis. This is a very serious and severe brain tumor, generally speaking. And so this is not something that is generally treated easily or cured. We, again, don't know the path that they're going to take for treatment, but this is a severe health issue right now for Senator McCain.
And I understand that they found this when they went in to deal with the blood clot that behind his eye. Is that what's been said?
Yeah, that's right. Last week he had surgery for a blood clot above his left eye. He had that clot removed, and he announced that on Saturday. His doctors did some follow-up tests. He stayed away from the Senate this week. He's going to be away at least through all the rest of this week. They did some follow-up tests, and they found this tumor, and that is the announcement that his office made last night, and it really took Capitol Hill by shock. There was an outpouring of support and sadness, really, for Senator McCain. People in both parties coming out, expressing their support, saying this is a fighter, this is somebody who was taken prisoner of war, and, you know, if there's anybody who can meet the challenge of such a serious medical condition, it's Senator McCain.
You've got 100 U.S. senators. What does it mean for the political chemistry of Washington, Capitol Hill, maybe the country, that this senator is now facing this challenge?
It's very significant in a couple of different ways. For one thing, you have a 52-48 split in the Senate right now, so 52 Republicans, 48 Democrats. That is a narrow majority for Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader. He's struggled to get members of his own Republican conference to support pretty much anything. They can't get behind a health care bill. There's little else that they can really agree on. So if you take John McCain out of the picture, you now have 51 Republican senators. So you have the narrowest possible majority, and you're already having problems getting your own Republican members in line if you're Mitch McConnell. So this is significant because it means that anything that Mitch McConnell wants to do, if he loses more than one of his own Republican senators, unless he can get any Democrats on board, whatever it is he's trying to do is essentially dead.
What might that mean for the initiatives that Mitch McConnell most cares about looking forward?
Well, right now, his most immediate task is health care, and that looks like it's not going anywhere with or without John McCain in the picture. But you look ahead to the other big-ticket items that McConnell and President Trump want to do. You look at things like tax reform. You look at things like an infrastructure bill. These are big, sweeping initiatives that the Republicans say they want to do, but it's going to be difficult for them because we are going to see, I think, the same kind of recalcitrance that we've seen in the healthcare debate. You're going to see Republicans unable to agree on things. And with such a narrow majority, McConnell's going to make a decision at some point. Is he going to want to craft something where he can work with Democrats, maybe get 2, 3, 4 Democratic votes? Or is he going to say, you know, I need to just count on Republicans? Well, if he goes with the latter and just counts on Republicans, again, he's 51 right now, if we don't know when Senator McCain is going to come back. And with 51, you have a really, really razor-thin margin for error if you're Mitch McConnell, and that's got to scare him right now.
Could that mean a change in his tack as Senate leader, that he might look for policies or positions that might attract that are more moderate, that might even attract Democratic support?
You know, it could, and he really is at a crossroads right now, especially after the apparent failure of this health care push in which he relied solely on Republicans and it still failed. So he might look in that direction, but it would really have to be something very, very narrow. The prospects of Republicans and Democrats working together on anything big in terms of taxes, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of health care, the odds of that seems very, very, very low right now. These parties are so far apart. There's so little they disagree. There's so little they agree on. It's very, very difficult to envision Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi sitting at a table, shaking hands and coming up with some sort of deal, because the disagreements are so, so stark right now. So it's a real challenge for McConnell if he does want to go in the direction of trying to work with Democrats, because the question is, what does he work on with them? And I don't think the answers are very clear right now.
John McCain is an important vote, but he has a single vote, and yet he's more than that. How would you describe his influence, his voice within the Washington political arena?
Yeah, he really is more than that. He's a real titan in the Senate. He's somebody who's been around for decades. He's somebody who speaks his mind, whether he disagrees with the president, who's a member of his own party, whether he disagrees with Democrats. He's not somebody who kind of holds back or, you know, hedges what he's saying. And it's important to remember that as we talk about the prospect of bipartisanship, well, here's somebody who's actually done it. John McCain worked with Democrats to try to get a comprehensive immigration reform bill. It didn't work, but he was part of those discussions. He worked with Russ Feingold, a Democrat, on campaign finance reform. So if there was one figure in this gridlocked, deadlocked Senate right now who might be able to break the ice, who might be able to give way to some bipartisanship, it would be John McCain, because he has this resume and experience of working with Democrats and Republicans. So without him in the picture personally, the odds of any sort of bipartisan deal and the tone in the Capitol seems to be headed even more in the direction of strident partisanship, because he's not there.
What's the feeling around Capitol Hill? I mean, this is a serious challenge. Are people presuming, and he's a tough fighter, everybody knows it, he's proven that over years, but people assuming he'll come back, or maybe not?
Yeah, I think they wonder whether he will or not. And he is a fighter, and he is somebody who his entire life has dealt with setbacks and tough, tough situations. But I think if you look at the tone of a lot of the statements that we've seen from both Democrats and Republicans, nobody's presuming anything. There is a lot of sadness right now. There's a lot of sorrow. Members of both parties, young and old, are wishing him well. But I think they are wondering when or even if he's going to come back to the Senate.
A very singular kind of career and a different tone. We remember him on the campaign trail up against Barack Obama, very respectful and insisting on a certain kind of basic decency, even when voters in the crowds were not ready to go there. Senator John McCain of Arizona, now fighting brain cancer. Sean Sullivan, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, we're grateful to you for being with us for a minute today. Thank you very much, Sean.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.